proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. I'm your host, Aaron Bronson, and I want to thank you for tuning in to today's program. Israel abortion law is now among the most liberal in the world. That was a recent headline from the news source, The Times in Israel. According to the article, the Israeli Health Ministry has expanded its, quote, health basket to include free abortions for women aged 20 to 33. Now, women whose age was outside this range were already offered free abortion coverage. Now, to understand this in context, Israel has a socialized healthcare system which offers free or low-cost benefits for all citizens. The process to get an abortion in Israel requires standing before a three-member committee to explain their situation. However, this is more or less a formality as 98% of these cases are approved. As believers in Jesus, especially those of us in America, we tend to view the abortion issue as an American issue. As tragic as the abortion rate is in the United States, it is important to know that this is not just an American problem. Of course, most have heard about China's one-child policy, which has recently been eased, at least that's what they put out in their media source. But abortion is widely accepted practice in many places of the world. Russia, in particular, reports that there are actually more abortions performed than live births. Canada also allows abortions to take place at any time during the pregnancy, with most being covered by insurance. Now, these are just a few examples from around the world. There have been over 2 million abortions performed since the State of Israel was founded in 1948. To put that number in comparison, just look at the Holocaust, which is really not that long ago, where approximately 1.5 million children were killed by the Nazi regime. Today in Israel, women who serve in the Israeli Defense Forces are offered two free abortions. Now, if they choose to keep the baby, they are dismissed from the army. About 40,000 abortions are performed annually, with half of these being done illegally. Another interesting observation that my family has witnessed firsthand is that Israel is very high in the world rankings in the number of prenatal testings done. Now, doctors encourage the mother to take almost every test imaginable in order to monitor the development of the baby. And if there's any hint of a problem, the mother is encouraged to seek an abortion. The rationale is that Israeli mothers want a perfect child and then entertain the idea of an abortion if the child is not perfect. Now, another factor in the high abortion rate is economic pressure. Now, most women choose to abort their baby thinking they cannot afford it. Now, as we look again at the headline on the expansion of abortion in Israel, a question comes to my mind. Many Christians think of Israel as the Holy Land. They view the current government as a true democracy in the Middle East with a conservative leader. Another thought you may have is this. Was there any protest, even among ultra-Orthodox Jewish people? Unfortunately, very little was said to oppose this decision. Many Israelis are passive concerning this issue. But most of this passivity is due to lack of education concerning the actual development of a baby. Most in Israel look at abortion like an appendectomy. In other words, it's like a normal procedure. In reality, this is anything but a normal procedure. It is the taking of an innocent life. Now, God is the author of life, and as the author of life, He gives a choice. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19 reads, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. This choice here is ultimately to live for God. One way we can do this practically is to help sustain life by sharing the truth that life is a gift from God, and we should do all in our power to care for people in an effort to bring them to God, and this starts in the womb. Fortunately, in spite of this troubling news from Israel concerning the abortion trend, there are those who are standing in the gap to rescue the unborn. We will look at these people and their efforts there on tomorrow's program, so I invite you to tune back in for that. But until then, let's now go to our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman, with today's Bible lesson.
Welcome back to our radio broadcast. This program is the second part of a multi-part series about civil disobedience and the Bible. Again, before engaging in civil disobedience, a Christian must address these questions. Does the Bible ever authorize the practice of civil disobedience? If it does, Under what circumstances ought a Bible believer to engage in civil disobedience? A Christian can choose one of three possible positions on this subject. In the first place, they might argue that a Christian need not comply with any edict they reckon to be contrary to God's will. Another option involves submitting to every legislative act or regulation that comes from a secular government. A third possibility entails following the laws of the land, except when such regulations mandate that people do evil. In this introductory segment, we will examine the first argument, that is to say that believers need not comply with any edict they feel goes contrary to the will of God. In the first place, the New Testament scriptures do not seem to support this contention. Indeed, key New Testament figures counsel their followers to submit to authorities, both religious and political. For example, Jesus Christ told his Jewish contemporaries in Jerusalem, quote, "Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's," unquote. He did not qualify that statement by asserting that, since Caesar had a divine right to rule over Israel, the Roman emperor therefore had the authority to collect taxes from the Jewish people. Nor did the Savior insist that Caesar must demonstrate his legitimacy to rule over the Jewish people. Instead, he recognized the political realities of his time and advised others to do likewise. The Savior also taught the Jews of his day to obey their spiritual leaders. He told the Jewish audience in Matthew chapter 23 that, quote, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do," unquote. The authors of the New Testament epistles likewise commanded believers to obey their rulers. Paul addressed the Christians in Rome as follows, quote, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." When Paul wrote to Titus about his congregation in Crete, Paul instructed his protege in the third chapter of Titus to, quote, "Put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates," unquote. In the 13th chapter of Hebrews, the author wrote, quote, "Obey them that have the rule over you, and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy, and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you." Though the context of that passage implied that the writer referred to, quote, "them that have the rule over you," quote, as applying to church leadership, the text itself did not specifically state that that was the case. Peter commanded the readers of his first epistle, quote, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake," unquote. His statement left no room for believers to question whether or not those ordinances conformed to God's directives. Those who believe that the Bible explicitly endorses civil disobedience as a general principle might cite Old Testament examples of individuals who did defy governmental orders, yet prospered. Let us have a look at some of these potential examples. We first look at the two midwives in Egypt. In the first chapter of Exodus, the author recorded an incident in which two women, Shifra and Puah, served as midwives in Egypt. They disregarded the reigning Pharaoh's order to kill the newborn sons of the enslaved Hebrew women. The text indicated that God dealt well with the midwives. Does the example of these two women justify the notion that a person can choose whether or not to obey a specific law? Consider the context. As a supreme ruler in Egypt, the Pharaoh held life and death power over all of his subjects, including the Hebrew slaves. Thus, he had the legal authority to issue his command, even though it was immoral. Did the two midwives therefore have a moral obligation to obey the Pharaoh's mandate? Note that Pharaoh had ordered these women to become de facto murderers of newborn males. In other words, he wanted them to do something that directly contravened divine authority, namely take life without justification. The Pharaoh's command also directed the midwives to violate any potential oaths they might have taken about preserving life. In such a case, Shifra and Puah had to make a choice. Do they obey God, or do they obey the Pharaoh? They chose to obey God. Next, we have the situation of Rahab and the two Israelite spies. Joshua had sent men to the city of Jericho in order to look at the land. They encountered Rahab, who hid them in her house. When the king of Jericho ordered her to produce those men, she refused to comply. In fact, she lied to that monarch about her guest's whereabouts, misleading him in that manner. The author of Hebrews included Rahab as an example to emulate, remarking that, quote, "By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace," unquote. Did God thereby endorse Rahab's course of action? A careful reading of the passage in Hebrews might clarify this matter. Rahab received praise from the author for deciding to ally herself with the true God, the God of Israel. Her reception of Joshua's spies demonstrated the sincerity of her choice. However, the Bible did not indicate either explicitly or implicitly. The Bible did not indicate that God approved of the tactics she used in making that choice. Had Rahab turned the Israelite men over to the king of Jericho, those men would certainly have been killed. However, God would still have given the city over to the advancing Jewish army. We can conclude thus that Rahab's deception did not in any way advance God's plan for the Israelites' victory. Here's another situation. In the book of 1 Kings, we read about Obadiah and the Lord's prophets. During the reign of King Ahab over the northern kingdom of Israel, Obadiah served as the governor of the king's house. Obadiah hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in caves at a time when, according to the author of 1 Kings, quote, "Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord," unquote. Did Obadiah thereby engage in an acceptable form of civil disobedience? The context of the 1 Kings passage indicated that the order to kill the Lord's prophets came from Jezebel, though Ahab may have approved of her policy. Jezebel served as the queen consort of Israel. That is to say, she held her position by virtue of her marriage to Ahab. She was not the queen regnant of Israel, ruling over that kingdom in her own right. A person can contend that Jezebel had exceeded her authority by issuing commands in her own name in a kingdom over which she did not reign, where she was married to the rightful king. In such a situation, Obadiah had no legal reason for submitting to a directive from someone who had, in fact, overstepped her proper authority. Some years later, a similar situation popped up in the kingdom of Judah. This circumstance related to the then high priest Jehoiada and the then reigning queen Athaliah. Athaliah was a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. She assumed control of the government of Judah after the death of her son Ahaziah. Jehoiada later led a revolt that resulted in Athaliah's death. Did the uprising that deposed Athaliah comprise an acceptable act of civil disobedience? The Bible student must remember that Athaliah, as her mother Jezebel, Athaliah functioned as the queen consort of Judah. She was not the legitimate ruler of that kingdom. In fact, she had usurped that position, which properly belonged to her grandson Joash, who she unsuccessfully sought to kill. The high priest Jehoiada's actions in overthrowing Athaliah merely sought to re-establish the rightful order of succession and restore the rightful authority over the kingdom of Judah. Thus, he did not engage in civil disobedience by resisting duly constituted authority. Each of those Old Testament examples cited show that those who disobeyed their leaders based their actions upon their ultimate allegiance to God. None of them arbitrarily decided to reject an order from their rulers, based upon their conception of right and wrong. We'll continue this series in future segments. Please come back for these messages about civil disobedience.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee 37343. Or call us at 423-876-8150. Or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.